Fine.
Yes, and I'm going to try and cover absolutely everything. That's really what I'm going to try and do. So I'm going to attempt to do that. So it's the theory of everything, but really, underlying it all really is the Dutch bicycle balance system, in case anybody's heard of that. It's basically, I wanted to show some of the stuff we've done in the LCDS and how I wanted it to fit into an overall picture really. It didn't make it into the final document, but I thought I'd share it anyway, just so you could see how my mind was working when I put certain things together really. So here's the sort of Dutch bicycle balance system that I kind of adapted really. So we're starting off with the kind of network development process. I'm going to talk about that, how you actually plan a network from like a core principles really. I'm going to talk about the cycle level of service assessment, which is one of the key bits of the London Cycling Design Standards. I should explain who I am really. I suppose I had the introduction, but for the past year and a half I've been working on the London Cycling Design Standards, which is out for draft at the moment. We're just finishing off deadline on Friday for the final version, so that's kind of what I'm doing. But that's a great point.
This is version 2 of the
LCDS. You're early.
Well, I like to call it version 3. I'm the London Cycle Network Design Guide as well. So for me, this is the third one. Yeah. And there was like an unreleased one as well. So there's like it's kind of a four hole.
Right.
So yeah, it's taken a while, but the last one was 2005, so it's a good 10 years, and a lot of water's gone under the bridge since then, really. So I've certainly thought about a lot of things in those 10 years from what went into the 2005 one. But back to the topic. So I'm going to talk about network development. I'm going to talk about how you actually measure rideable quality of routes. And then I'm going to talk about some other infamous like stakeholder engagement, what I'm doing tonight, for example. Although I don't particularly like that word stakeholder. I like to know just people who know and people who don't. And then a little bit of policy assessment, which was like the most controversial thing that I wanted to try and get into the balance system. You can't just like do infrastructure without having the right supporting policies there. So I'm going to talk about that. And another critical factor, the impacts on pedestrians. We don't want cycling stuff to come at the effects of making it worse for pedestrians, really. And I'm going to show how all that fits in with those basic Dutch principles of safety, directness, coherent, attractive, comfortableness. Our London-based one, the adaptability, and show it all fits in to make overall profile. So without any further ado, that's too long an introduction for how much I'm going to go through. Let's talk about the first one, coherence at network level. This is in Chapter 2 of the LCDS. I think it's quite useful, especially like if you start from scratch. I know we've been developing cycle networks in London for a long time, so this is also will tell you where the deficiencies are. So. And our step one really is to get an idea of what the existing conditions are. This is our sort of generic any town from the LCDS. We've shown on it where the existing cycle routes are. There's a little bit of Greenway, a little bit of National Cycle Network, some old bits of LCN, LCN Plus kind of floating around, never quite finished off. And we've also shown where there's key bits is, like a pedestrianised sort of town centre educational establishments, schools, places of interest. And also these dark lines here are to show what we like to call active frontages. So there's stuff going on in that street. That's the kind of high street, really. So that's our first picture. And the next four stages are really testing to see where there's deficiencies in that. Where do we need to focus the money to make a coherent network?
What did you thought?
So yeah, well, step two is rather fancily named mesh density analysis, which is really just how tightly packed is the network. The Dutch say every 400 metres, and these are 400 by 400 metre grids overlaid on there should be a decent cycle route, a high quality one that you can ride on every 400 metres. They say in their town centres it should be every 250, but really I'm in London at the moment just trying to get a basic network density. Now, at the moment, if you looked at Westminster, there's probably one reasonable east-west. Camden's got a decent north-south, but then that's 4 miles apart. And I want every 400 metres in the end. So this is testing what's there against the Dutch sort of basic network principle. So I've kind of shown a little bit of heat mapping around it. So now where they're only 200 metres apart, it's getting a little bit hot there. I've got more than a need. Fantastic. But, we're here now, and you could tell just by looking at the map, clearly that's where we've got a big hole in the network. It's not hot enough around there. It's getting a little bit cold. Let's have a look at a real world example of that. Here's like one in Greenwich. Pretty well covered over here, all this stuff, but clearly, and I did this in a slightly different way where I kind of bound areas inside the network really and compared that to a sort of a 0.16 square kilometre area, which would be ideal shown here really. So here's a bit cool, we need a few more routes down there really. But it's worth taking it back to that basic one, because you can say, oh well, Greenwich has got a route, what are you talking about? And Bexley's got one as well, there's one that starts up on the bridge, runs right to Abbey Wood, there you go, you're covered. Well, that's like a 10-mile gap side to side. We're never really going to get cycling going unless we've got the right kind of density. So that's the first step, really.
Again, nice idea to develop a piece of software that could generate that automatically.
I've got it. Well, not automatically. If you press all the buttons in the exact order I tell you, on map info, it will do it.
Okay.
So I've got to say,
deriving it from the map. But yeah. Then you can see the evolution, year by year.
Oh yeah, and no, definitely cleverer people than me with the software will do it. I've got a GIS way of generating that for borough officers.
Good.
That's fairly, what's it, idiot proof. I've just said it. And so our step three would be like a sort of road classification audit, really. Or you could call it the sort of bikeability audit assessment, which Camden's already done. How rideable are all the roads at what kind of level of skill? This is all dead easy stuff, so I won't sort of dwell on it, but what we do with it next is interesting. The good news is the vast majority of London roads are completely cyclable at level 2. It's at least like 80%. And that, you know, that's the good news. Most of our roads are fine. It's just you don't have to go too far before you come across something that isn't. And that's the next step, really. Let's have a look at that. Whipping along nicely. There's an example from the same area of a Greenwich there. All these roads, if you've been trained to bikeability level 2, are no problem for you. These ones that we have to sort of think about. That shows you the sort of percentage though. London's quite good already. So what the next step, step 4, we use these difficult roads to bound areas. So everything inside this road, inside this area, is all cyclable at that basic level. These little G's here where we've got a nice crossing across the difficult road, so a level 2 level person will be able to ride across there from one area to the next. And so if you can get into an area and get out of an area at level 2 rideability, it's green. Yeah, go for it.
What age would you have to be bikeability level 2?
Well, any age, it's just whenever you've reached the skill level. They don't do it for really young. Normally bikeability level 2 they're doing like about 10-11, that kind of age range. Yeah. So you're happy mixing with traffic, but when it gets a bit busier, that's really like level 3 when it starts to become teams and that sort of thing. So really, but like it's just basically says it's a nice way of getting from one area to the other. So like a classic Camden gateway, say, would be Ossleton Street across Euston Road. You've got a bloody awful six-lane road. You've got a nice crossing way of just cutting across and it keeps you level 2 outside. That's one of the gateway point. So if you can get into an area and get out of it, it's basic level, that's green. If you get in but there's no way out across the next move, it's orange. And if there's no way in or out, it's basically an unporous part of the network. And it's a good way of looking at a whole area rather than like, you know, we're planning a route when we're going this way and it goes that way. Well, really the route should be secondary to the nodes. That's what I'm always saying to people. If you're going to plan a network that works for everybody, start with your crossing points across a difficult road, and then the route really becomes the most efficient way of getting between your points. That's so really like basic network planning.
Yep. If all your crossing points went east-west, but there was one side of the road, it would all be green. But if you want to go north-south, it would be...
Yeah, there's rules. It gets a little bit... So if there were two on that end, then yeah, that wouldn't cover it.
No, really. But if they were all on the east and west... Yeah.
And
you could go east and west, but you wouldn't be able to go north and south.
Well, yeah, like
but
say, well, if we've got that basic, well, I'm talking about just getting basic networks going here now. Like, once you start to go, well, really, Dutch would say, yeah, at least for every certain area, it should be every corner of it. You know, two for every corner, every 400 metres, every 250 metres along there. That's the mesh density that kind of picks that up, really. But yeah, no, agreed. I just want to be able to get across London at the moment. But, you know, that's the difference we're talking about. If you look at central London, it's all these red pockets. The whole of London is. I did Croydon the other day, and it was just a big swath of like unconnected areas. And we go, oh, why is nobody cycling in Croydon? Well, there's no way across any of these difficult roads. If I could just get east-west at the moment, I'd grab your hand off for offering me that. So So yeah, we need to get there. At the moment, I just want to show good news, and then we can like start upping the level of it later on, really.
Right, can I just put down a marker that you said that Crossing Euston Road in Ossington Street is level 2.
Yeah.
I think you need iron pills to go across that junction at times. It's blocked up. You've got to know that you can turn south against the red signal. It's not level 2.
I agree. I would defend that it is kind of level 2. It's right on that sort of area. I suppose if I said like Colesbrook Row in Islington, that's a pretty good one. Maybe Boundary Road, that crossing there of like the A41. We have that as a gateway?
Yeah.
That's good. And that's what's great about doing this with local like cyclists. You'll know them all, because that'll be the way you cycle around. If you're heading over to Kilburn now, you probably would end up doing that Boundary Road. If you're heading south, you probably would do Ossleton, whether you think or not. It's like trying to get those golden points that you know about into the network planning. Okay.
I just wanted to say, so Paul's point raises the highlights the fact that detailed design at every intersection, even if you think you have got permeability.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You have to review it.
You're leading perfectly into the next stage. But that's all. We're kind of getting in. We're starting at that macro level, and we're zooming all our way in there, and then we're gonna. That's why. So here's another example, really. And the point I want to make here is like a crossing means a lot. It's rather like a. It used to be on the LCN and the LCN Plus. It was all about link length delivered and routes delivered. And go, well, why bother doing a crossing? It's only going to give me 15 metres. Let's throw in this advisory cycle lane for a mile and a half, and then a bank that much kilometrage. And really, what I want to say is, if you put one crossing in, it's route enabled all these roads. It's like 40 kilometres worth of a road network, it's all cyclable. And this 20 kilometres here, you can get across really. So. That's a good way of looking at crossings, in my opinion. And in this one here, Greenwich, they do want to connect up schools to residential areas. You do this, you put the crossings in, it kind of shows what the impact is. So the next step really is what you're all waiting, really, to get into a bit more infrastructure detail. The level of service stuff comes in at like a step 5. Really, on our example here, it's kind of done level of service on all the roads, but in actuality, you probably would pick some of your best routes depending on where you wanted the mesh density to go and where you wanted to connect the gateways, and then you could use the level of service to make an assessment. So I'm going to step into level of service now, because I did say I'd do everything. So the level of service, we've kind of done coherence at the network level. Now we're going to look at defining safety, directness, comfort, attractiveness, coherence, and adaptability. All these things are covered in the level of service. And for me, it's one of the key bits of the new LCDS. And I will say it's the bit of the LCDS that the Commissioner liked the most, because it kind of has that scoring element of judgment about it. It measures how far off we are from some of our international counterparts. It works in like three levels, really. We've got a kind of basic level of service, as typified by that picture there. Nothing's really been done, it's just the road, that's what we're all kind of riding in right now. You mix them with heavy traffic, you mix them with everybody. If you provide that, people who cycle already cycle there anyway, but it's not really going to entice many new people to start cycling. We're just kind of now that, really. At the kind of good, and that use of the word good is something Tom Bogdanovich is all over me about at the moment. It's like a bit of a meh, and this is good. But like, anyway, the red, amber, green kind of shows my feelings of it, really. That's all I'll say about that one. At the kind of good level, it's not the cycle lane that's making that good, I hasten to add. It's the surface quality. We've got a bit of brand new surface carriageway there, so that comfort criteria has been met. And also this near side lane width between the centre line and the edge of the curb there is about 5 metres, 4.5, 5 metres. So we've got space for people to overtake them. So you've got a bit of effective width going on there. That's put it there. It might be amazingly enticing to new people, but it's a pretty good level of service if you provide that, I'll say. Although there's quite a range on good, from 40 to 70%. So I will say, of the level of service, you end up getting an overall score out of 100. I'm going to break it down shortly for you as well. And the kind of highest level of service means everybody could do it, like young, old, happy, sad, rich, poor. They're all going to be happy cycling or something like that. It's typified by Goldsmith Row in Hackney there, where they've closed the street off to all but cycling and pedestrian traffic. If there's no traffic there whatsoever and it's a pleasant environment, nothing's going to be more enticing to cyclists in that situation.
Let's have a look. Let's break it down.
Here is the system. It's basically a series of things to look out for in the road and stuff. It's a kind of aid memoir list as well for scheme designers. Everything I want them to think about when they're actually doing a design. They end up getting an overall score out of 100 based on giving 0 points, 1 points, and 2 points. And there's also a critical level to kind of watch out for. We'll define that shortly as well. When you get this overall score out of 100, here's how we're rating against our international counterparts, really. The Dutch are all scoring 78%. They kind of know what they're doing. You know, they're stacked to that high level. The Danish are a little bit below because in terms of enticing new people to cycle, Danes always reintroduce cyclists back into junctions and mix them with traffic because they consider that safer, whereas the Dutch will keep you protected all the way through the junction and separated through there, so you're happy to ride through it with the kids. So that feeling of safety is what tips the Dutch over the Danes. Germans a bit below that, lots of stuff, not quite like as good a standard as the rest. And most of our routes that we provide in our facilities, and I was saying most of our roads are good, but when we do provide stuff, it's all coming in at this 37-40%, particularly our junction designs, which we'll get to shortly. So that's the state of affairs.
Did you test your level of service scheme against Dutch and things?
There's more and more, and I will be preparing a sort of companion document to the LCDS where you can see how much we went into it. It's already about 40, but it's longer than the LCDS. You can see why they didn't let me put it into the LCDS now, really. But I wanted some kind of measure, you guys have been campaigning for, a Love London, Go Dutch. And I go, we need some kind of measure of how we know when we get there, really. So this is kind of my attempt at doing that. Where did it all come from? It's based pretty loosely now on the IHT cycle review method, which came out in 1996. And I always ask engineers and planners who used it. And over the past year and a half, I've had about four hands go up, really. Wasn't really particularly well used out there, but I thought it was fantastic because I'm completely obsessed with numbers, which we'll find out over the next half an hour. And I like the fact that you could break everything down into measurable sort of indicators of rideable quality. Here's an example of it there, really. And they've got a section there on which I've kind of circled. Because I noticed there was a few things in the cycle review that didn't bear scrutiny these days. For example, they had a complete linear relationship between the near side lane width and the overall level of service score. So the wider that lane width got, the higher the score for level of service in terms of comfort. Sounds reasonable, but when you've actually put cycles routes in there, you know any lane width between 3.2 and 4 is that iffy lane width. Cyclists don't know whether to take the sort of primary position, cars don't know whether they've got enough space to go past them, and you get a mixed situation, and that third most populous type of collision, the collision from alongside, is most likely to happen in that kind of situation. So I wanted to get some real world experience into this system and soup it up a little bit, really. Just a little note on academia, because I'd like you to know that it's all assured. Professor John Parkin, and I'm sure a lot of you know, is our foremost cycling academic, and the guy who trained me back in the day. He had a measure of level of service based on just on how you calculate risk, your own personal risk, and it's really good, and it completely stands up. It's basically if you go up to a major gyrator in the six lanes going past you can go, that looks pretty risky, it's not providing a very good level of service, or a road like Goldsmith Road, you go, I don't feel any risk here, it's providing a pretty good level of service. That takes it all down to one factor. What I felt John was missing, though, was all the other contributing factors, the comfort, the attractiveness, the greening, all these things go to make a sort of rideable quality. So by taking it down to one, I kind of felt we'd missed the aid memoir for designers there, really. John compared his system with the IHT cycle review system, and he found that they actually correlated. So this was brilliant for me, because I had a professor who'd studied it to the max with a completely robust system, saying that it correlated with a system that had been much maligned over the years, really. So I thought, if you look at everything, it adds up roughly, maybe some things more than others, but it adds up roughly to what John's saying in there. So I took that as carte blanche that there was some kind of academic backing behind that.
What was the thing that he was, you said there was one thing that he was
risk, how you perceive risk,
personal perception of risk, just arbitrarily done by individuals.
Yep.
are there not some...
It wasn't quite arbitrary.
No, no.
Very
no,
objective.
Sorry.
And, yes,
but
still
individuals.
Yeah, individual perception of risk. Yeah.
Are there not some situations where you've got a false sense of security, but there is risk?
Exactly, and we're going to get to that as well, the feeling of safety stuff. So I'll just talk about other things that went into it first, but yeah, hold that thought, because I'm definitely going to come back to it. The LCC's Go Dutch Matrix. Do listen, and I did listen, there were some really good ideas in here, certainly some more subjective things. This was the LCC's attempt to define what they felt made a good cycle route. And I brought some of the factors in there, particularly like this adaptability idea as well, of bringing that in. It was a little bit more sort of program specific and subjective, but I thought if I mashed that with like the engineer look on the street, how many defects there are, kind of system, and then have a kind of picture of it all, that was the inspiration. Let's break down some of them now as well. Some of the documents that fed into it. This is the Cycle Safety Action Plan. The second version of this out at the moment, actually, just got published last week. Well worth looking at. It's got some really bold actions for TfL and for the boroughs to do for cycling. So if you haven't read that, please do. You'll find some big stuff. What it mentions, and this is how I knew John before, here's the four main types of collisions that occur with cyclists. We've got the collision from alongside. The right hook, like I said, more populous than the left hook, 12% to only 9% of left hooks. But the left hook is more like there's more likely to be a fatality, and it's that movement of HGVs that we're looking for. And that's stipulating a kind of door in near side activity kind of situation there. So as a designer, I wanted to look out for what is it in design that is most likely to give rise to these collisions. Let's have a look at some examples to make the point. If we were talking about left hook collisions, what would you design that would give you a left hook collision? That's an evil way of thinking about it. You'd probably design something a little bit like this, where you'd put a cycle lane in there. Again, yeah, brilliant, you've done some cycling, but it's a really narrow near side lane and it's multi-lane, so really there's no space. You can see the car straddling the lane, enticing you to go down there on a multi-arm approach to a signalised roundabout. You're making a situation where the collision from alongside is likely to happen, and when you get there, the left hook collision is quite likely to happen. It's more likely to happen in that kind of situation. So that's why that's got a red board around it, and why we think that's a low level of service. Someone could say, well, the cycle lane in there, it doesn't matter, it's the situation we're assessing, the actual rideable quality. And this middle one here is amber, this is a bow roundabout. Again, when cyclists turn up at the signals here, they get a green at the first arrow there, they go through to the next stop line, there's cars right there, then you get a green there, at the same time as the vehicles go there, you've got a little bit of an advantage in terms of space, you're further on into the junction, so you can clear the junction before the left hookers come in there. That's the theory with bow roundabout. Why isn't that green? Probably many of you have rode it, you'd probably be able to tell me, but whenever you turn up as a cyclist at this junction, it's always red. You don't get the same amount of time as the traffic going through there. When they go, you're held there, and you have to wait the whole cycle, 120 seconds for it to come all the way around back to you again. So there's stuff in the level of service about journey time relative to cars, and we want to know that you're not losing out time on your own cycle. So that's kind of why that's not working. And our green example, if you wanted to resolve the left hook issue, and I don't have to tell Camden cyclists too much about this one, but separately signalling the left turn for the motor traffic. So in this sample here, we've got green and green for ahead traffic, and that stops, and then our left turning motor vehicles get their own stage in the signal cycle to just put across there. No conflict whatsoever. The downside to that is that that's kind of half the road, and we're going to find another half of the road, and how many epic boulevards have we got in London to actually do this? I know we could talk about that one all day, but that's the left hook one.
We found another outlet for our frustration.
Oh yeah.
I don't mean a person, but we found another.
Picture of me that you can manage this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about collision risk. Yep.
So going back to the previous slide.
Yep.
I was just wondering why it would be that. So there seems to be cars going in the same direction, yellow cars and green car bikes are going in the same direction.
Yep.
So why the island is needed in the middle there and couldn't be
They're turning left.
Yeah, this is just for left turners, yeah.
Yeah, but why the island needs to protect between the two rows of cars rather than the island protect between...
Yeah, well, yeah, it's basically our signal layouts, really, yeah. To separately signal that.
I think a Dutch Junction would take the protection around the corner, wouldn't it? So
well, we're going to get to Dutch Junctions. Okay. Yeah, that's the...
There's an unreadable amount of road space taken up there.
Yeah, well, yeah, do we have to? Maybe not, maybe there's other ways, but, you know, that's kind of way at the moment. So anyway, we looked at actual collision risk, but we were asking the level of service to that. Now, what about the feeling of safety as well? This is the TfL Attitudes to Cycling report, the latest version's out from 2013 at the moment. Well worth looking at if you want to find out why don't people cycle, and this is the main reasons people cycle, why they don't cycle. One, they're not healthy enough to do it. So I go as a design engineer, not a lot I can do about that. The weather, it's too cold, wet, well, all right. We're in England, fair enough. But this one here, too dangerous, that's the one that, you know, I think, well, we're all trying to do something about, and that's the one I particularly take on board as a highway today. So how can I make things feel less dangerous? Let's have a look at our red amber green examples again, really. This one here might have a brilliant safety record, but how safe are you going to feel in the middle of the guardrail, cutting across all this line marking in the middle of, like, a hatch junction there? Not going to be particularly enticing to new people to cycle there. Might well be that all this mess is making people go through, they go, oh, what's going on, and that's keeping them safe. By not feeling safe, but like, we don't necessarily want that. The mayor's asked me to do designs that's going to double the amount of cyclists we have in London, and putting this sort of stuff on the ground isn't going to get my new bums on seats, as it were. So there's a big difference between the collision risk and the actual feeling of safety as typified there. Now this middle example here, you might feel a lot safer in the deep blue comforting superhighway there, with the lane across the junction to stipulate that you can't get lost, that's the way the superhighway goes. But the accident record there, and we probably all know, might be a lot worse than that junction there, because people feel that there's some kind of provision there, particularly on the near side lane across the junction there. There's nothing stopping you or preventing you being left up there, so staying over to that near side when all the vehicles go isn't a particularly good idea. Any cycle trainer will tell you that. You probably want to be where that fella is there. So he knows, he's going, I've been trained, I'm going to ignore that nonsense. That's not where I want to be in the junction. So this might feel safer. I'm in the blue, it's all good, it's deep. But it's not actually safer. Like, a good solution would be something like this, that like counts both. It is safe, it feels safe. I run out of green examples, there's not a huge amount of them in London, so I'm going to keep calling on Hackney. I probably should have fed in some Camden examples.
I totally agree with these sort of blue, cross junctions. I completely
Why would any traffic engineer
actually do it?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you why. We're doing some research on the use of coloured surfacing at the moment. And it's interesting when it's what we call a conspicuity argument. You let, like, a general traffic know, you make cycling conspicuous there, and then when you do that turn, they go, ooh, or maybe a cyclist has come along, there's a big blue strip there. And when I've been doing the research, I've been watching focus groups and drivers in particular, what they say about the blue. And they all say, as soon as you see the blue there, they think it's a higher status route. They think almost like the blue's mandatory and the line markings don't mean anything else. So if you see the blue, that's where cyclists are, that's a high status route. Which sounds pretty good to use the blue. But then those same drivers will then later say, if you see the blue, then they just assume cyclists will be over there and they relax because they're not in it. And they're not looking around anywhere else, which is probably the last thing I'd want them to think in this town as well. So it's difficult, like... I have this argument a lot at work about the use of these lanes across there. In fact, is it like a wayfinding? Does it show drivers that they're cutting across the path of cyclists in their preferred position? That's the argument that'll be made. I wouldn't ever mark something unless that's the route that I would take across that junction, and that's not the route that I would take across that junction.
Yeah, I mean, in cycle training, I suspect advocate that as well.
Yeah. So I say with like the placement of the cycle symbols and lanes, it's the three golden rules really. It's got to work for wayfinding. You should tell you where you're going if you want a route and you're getting where you want to go. It's got to be that conspicuity of the vehicles, let them know, expect the presence of cyclists. And the third one, this is the recommended position that you should take. I mean, like the placement of the cycle symbol from DFT is just as a route wayfinding one. but we can't have, whatever you put something in the road, like a lane or a symbol, people are drawn to it and they're going to ride over it, so we have to acknowledge that there's those three functions of these things, and so it's the three golden rules there.
So in that instance, would you put the blue lane out in the middle more? A third of the way across?
That's not what I'd do. I'd be starting to actually get some knee junction options in there, which we're finally working on.
Given you haven't got the dosh for that, then I mean...
If it's just like that, I would have the lane across it personally. That's not a line I would take across that junction.
No, it isn't. I agree. Yeah. I mean, so you just shift. Would you shift the blue lane out a bit?
Well, then, is it tricky? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have the lane there. Personally, yeah.
Yeah, but Brian, I'm not going to rework CS2.
I know. Well, there's what I say, and then there's what my organisation does.
When I say to you, I meant your organisation.
Sorry, as TfL. Yes, we are still considering it. I mean, when it comes to the Super Highway guns, there's a different person signing off those designs, and he's all about the Danish. I'm all about the Dutch, and I concentrate on doing borough assessments and stuff. I still feed into the Super Highway stuff as well, and it's a big debate amongst us, and he's making the argument that I just made to you, really, and there's a lot of people that buy into that argument, I have to say, because it is working on that conspicuity side. There's no doubt about it. He does not as much as he used to.
Not on the blue junction. There's so many other factors there besides the paint. That's Vauxhall Bridge, right?
Yeah.
That is a really fast, really wide, really aggressive bit because you're about to enter a racetrack as you go down the river. And all that stuff is kind of, we're just talking about paint.
Yeah.
And so I presume that's
Hence, just in feeling, if I was doing it on the actual collision one, this would be red.
Mm.
That's the difference with the level of service. It's a lot to get through, but this is good. So really, I thought I'd show some things. I've only really concentrated on the safety, but that's 48 of the 100 points in the level of service. It's also stuff like how green it is, what's the surface quality, how many defects have you got there, undulations, what kind of undulations, are they sinusoidal, are they round top, all these things kind of figure in. But I thought it might be fun to show you some pictures of the road and ask what you would score this out of 100. Because I think like the test of any good system is if it kind of matches what you kind of would have thought anyway, based on what I've been talking about. So I'm going to show you some pictures of a neutral road in South London called Blackfriars Bridge Road. Yeah. There's a St George's Circus, that's a circus, not a roundabout. Moving up there, nice wide lane, bit of bus lane on the side there, no use of hatching there, interesting TfL feature. Moving up there, we've got some cycle lanes coming in the approach to the junction. How wide are they? Just over a metre. Standard TfL cycle lane width, still in there, standards there. Put a hatching ASL, that's that junction treated for cycling.
It's not a deliberate mistake here, but the bus doesn't have a yellow sticker on
it. Oh, yeah, this is from Google Maps. I need to do the latest one in there. And right up to where the magic happens, that's where I go. So I ride this every day now. What would you score my route to work out of 100?
From where?
For everything I showed you there, your overall impression. Of those four pictures that I showed you there, coming along there.
What's
that, 40 for the hair?
30.
25-ish, yeah.
25-ish.
Right. The thing is, it's the weak link, isn't it? I mean, there might be a bit of that, one or two of those, I thought that I don't look too bad, but then as soon as you put in the previous one, the whole route goes down to that level to me.
So what do you do if you're doing a level of service? Yeah. You'd split it into areas of similar characteristics. So if you had like a bit on like a fast long road, you do that one. Then if there was a little bit through residential, then another fast road. Do the two fast roads together, do the residentials, and then kind of you can average it across the route based on the length it's taken up there. So we were looking at about 25 to 40, weren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody went higher. Yeah, I will say when
partner wouldn't cycle on that.
Yeah,
and
your partner.
My partner wouldn't cycle, and she's...
It's a red route, it's a tricky situation. Also, when I did the LCDS training, and we do this in detail, I had like cycle trainers on there, like other cycle training on the first one. It was kind of, well, it's 100%. As long as you've been trained by me, everything's 100%. I
got
quite pashy round the entire nation.
If it was 20 mile an hour limit and there was some enforcement, I would put it up by about 10 points. I
think. Mm. So
take it to what kind of level?
In the 45 maybe. But well, we don't have much experience of enforced 20 miles an hour, but
yes.
In Camden there is a slightly better feeling since we've had the 20.
So when it's that wide, do you think they'll do if it's enforced
well,
at 20
enforced, yeah.
We haven't heard anybody enforced.
Alright, well, when I do it on the courses, and I did do this the other day, and it came out exactly as this, again, 37% is what it's going. So it was pretty much, we kind of averaged out of that a bit, really. And just to show that TfL, a fantastic organisation, we're doing something about it. The north-south route that's going in there with its really wide, I'm calling them bike roads rather than two-way tracks. My Camden people there know my history of two-way tracks and pulling them out. This kind of wipe on the board, it's scoring 86%. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the most expensive route I'll ever be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Over to the 90s. What would have really tipped it over the edge would be if they'd incorporated some kind of greening in there. And being a two-way road thing, there's going to be delays at the junctions associated with it, and some of the side roads is the potential for that. Sort of collisions we saw in Camden.
Does it lose much on adaptability?
Yeah, it loses loads. Yeah, that's another key area where it could have picked up on as well.
What
so
does adaptability
if it'd been
mean?
Well, yeah, it's saying one is a route like a growth enabled. So let's take Tavistock Place in Camden.
Yeah.
You know, brilliant route. Went in there. There's hardly anybody cycling. Nobody started cycling on it because it enticed loads of people on there. Quickly got to capacity, and I'm sure you all know you can have difficulty clearing the lights there at some stages going through there. But now to change it and to widen it slightly, but the same amount of money is putting it back in. So you'll have to dig up the old track and you have to reposition it. That means you'll have to, all carriageways have got crossfalls. So by inching in, you've altered the crossfall. Drainage won't work. So you're going to have to resurface the whole carriageway. Then, oh, my gully positions, because it's a... I'm going to have to reset those. Is my street lighting covering it? It all adds
it
on like it. It's not.
Really,
yeah, that is the adaptable thing. Well, yeah, if it's lighter stuff, then you can shift it around it. That's really one for that. But it's also like knowing that you've it can be in relation to cycle parking. It provided enough for like a demand now and also a future demand at that kind of high level service. That's what I'm looking for. And also flexibility of roadworks is the other key one as well. So, you know, we've all seen routes in Camden, like Route 6 is the classic one where the development's happening. We've lost that area south of Holborn for the past year and a half there. And there's no other real ways to go there. So it's like it's that kind of flexibility. If we have like backup routes to our network, then we can call them in there. So that's what that's concerned
with. How wide is your cycle road? 4 metres,
it's way wider than that. It's like 5-6 in places. Yeah, it's pretty good. And with it being a really tidal flow, we get huge amounts of people that way, really. So it has been, it's been matched to the existing and a little bit of a potential growth as well. But if it starts getting hugely popular, it could well have a problem with like the adaptability there.
Is that fully agreed?
Stuff we need to get another screen. It's not fully agreed, but it's just finished its consultation period, so we're assessing those at the moment. And I really shouldn't say how it's going. You're not drawing me on that one, and that'll be the next 40 minutes.
80%
positive is what the story was, isn't it?
You've got so much width that you can not only put in a nice wide cycle road, but you can put in a very large area in between, which makes it possible to turn right from or into that.
Yeah, it makes the separate roads work a little bit better because as cars go in, they can stop there.
Exactly.
So you can give the priority straight.
Yeah, that's the problem. You don't have the space.
And that's what we're looking for. Let's design these differently.
Just to stir things up, the other day I met a quad bike, that is, in the Royal College Street route. As we get wider in cycle lanes, we get... There aren't that many quad bikes in London.
Yeah, no, but brilliant. No. That was one of the reasons behind doing it nice and wide, so we could accommodate.
We don't want
bikes
too many of them.
A motorised.
Yeah,
proper quad bike, you know.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Right, oh,
no,
okay.
No, four people.
Ryan, on your power stop placing, I think most of us have got experience of the seven stations link, and other cyclists are the big problem there. You kick them over its own success, but it seems to me that if you build that north-south route, we have a mindset problem that there are the masters of the universe who want to get to work in 27 minutes and they're averaging 17 miles an hour, and then there's the Dutch or Danish model where everybody accepts that they will ride at the same speed. Now surely your 5 meter wide two-way section is actually going to create a problem with that mindset, because you're going to have people going at two different speeds and overtaking into the contraflow.
Well, I mean, we've got the cyclists we've got, there's no doubt about that, but I think, like, my experience with tracks is that people like a ride at a much like a slower speed in them, and I'm sure everybody in Camden will agree with me on that. You're going along Tavistock, people are dawdling along impacts. It's not a huge amount, it's not like a real speedway merchants you'll get on associated with the other superhighways stuff out there. Yeah, and that's it. I mean, well, you know, you have to go at the same speed of it. So I think if you provide nice stuff for people, one, you'll be able to overtake it, but you'll also be able to ride side by side and have a chat on the way in. So I'm hoping like this greater level of provision will civilise people. Like we've seen in Camden, I think you know, we're an example of that. When you provide stuff for people. Like, because people say to me, oh, cyclists are always jumping red lights. I go, well, not if you provide somewhere nice to stop and wait in it, like on Tavistock. They do wait, and you don't have that capacity flow through there. But you can just put your foot up and then go, oh, I'll put my foot up on that foot. It's not like you're mixing with traffic and you're looking for when the conflict's going to happen and you're like waiting to shoot off. It's a different mindset when you actually provide properly for people. So that's my theory. And we'll have to see.
I think I observe that too. When there's the systems are excellent, behaviour is better.
Yeah, indeed. So in terms of like links, what kind of links will get us our like a highest level of service? A kind of bicycle street approach, we've got hardly any traffic going on there, and we've got like some area kind of stipulated for cycling. That kind of profile will get you up there into the high figures on our sort of standard carriageway. We're getting a little bit wider. Recognise the profile here, or the sort of Royal College Street approach with the floated parking on the contraflow and the roof flow wide lanes. That's going to get you up there. That's another one of our high scores. Getting a little bit wider, another fairly recognisable profile of being along by the river there, past embankment. We've got our wide cycle road, our separated island, and the rest of the traffic. Do what you want to do. That's all going to get you quite high scores. But there is another element of the level of service, and that's a quick way of assessing junctions, which I felt was really desperately needed. I'd watched like the junction review process and saw people got involved in long technical arguments about saturation flows and capacity and all the constraints of different modes, but I wanted just like something a child would understand. How easy is it to do every movement? So on a crossroad junction like this, there's 12 possible movements you can make, and certainly one of the criticisms I gave to the superhighway projects, to go, right, oh, the superhighway's going across there, we'll sort that out, two out of possible 12 movements are kind of dealt with. That's not good enough for me now, really. On the example here, just to explain, it's the red and the green as well, with the zero for red, one for amber, two for the green, which kind of mirrors all the way through this balance stuff. But these ones with like the black and the cross means it's a banned movement, so that gets 0 points as well. The red gets, we're saying that's a trickier movement than that right turn because of like a far side refuge there to kind of shadow in as you turn across. This way you're going right into conflict and you're having to find your own space. So clearly we're just like colouring every single movement, just really as a way, like with the level of service, of getting engineers to think about every single movement, not just like how do we normally do junctions or I'll stick an ASL in there. That's not really going to be good enough. This is like a straight on the collision risk. That isn't green in actuality. I just wanted to show you different colours on that. The drawing there. There's not many signalised junctions in the UK where I've got any green movements on. Like green being defined as anybody can do at any kind of skill level. Most of them have got the odd amber and are mainly kind of red, really. So So well, let's have a look at a junction which you might have looked at, but maybe not through these eyes. Royal College Street Extension, Camden Road. The route goes that way. Fantastic. These are all green. The straight ahead on the right, the left's banned, 0 points. Going back the other way, the ahead and the left's green because you've got your own stage of the cycle. Fantastic. That's going pretty well. All the other movements are either still banned or bloody tricky to do. So that's giving you 11 out of 24 as an overall junction score, which is like just under like a 50%. I set my TFL colleagues for all the grid intersections with the TLRN what is 50% minimum. I just wanted to show just how hard it is to get to 50% in our junction. This is where we're losing all our points. So we don't have enough junction options, I would say, really. And we're not kind of looking at it this way. So they've taken that on board and they're trying every trick in the book, really, and a few more that were invented through trials to actually try and get to that kind of 50%. Yep.
I was meeting with local residents and they were bemoaning the fact there wasn't crossing over Camden Road, just sort of parallel to going to the other side.
Okay.
But it seems to me, I said that I thought that if that was allowed for the cyclists to go ahead, you don't have to stop the cyclists turning left. And there are many different techniques, one of which would be to put a low level signal in the cyclists. And the officer there said, I said, well, I'm sure you can when the TSLD comes in next spring. And he said something like, you couldn't fix it.
Yeah, well, in junction design, I could probably sort the whole section out. I mean, you'll know this anyway. We can't have any kind of cycle route at the same time as ped move. Cyclists are classified as vehicles in signals, so you can't have a vehicle on ped conflicts. This is what's different about our like a junction design. It's pretty much everywhere else in the world where you can allow that. In Copenhagen, if it would be that white, but let's assume they didn't like. Never a vehicle got green to do a left. You always expect pedestrians to be going on that same arm, so you can have a quick turn around in cycles.
Yeah,
and so when everybody turns, they're always looking out for someone.
Why can't
you
put a low-level signal for the cycle to turn
its red? What, here? And have an internal stop light?
Where they turn around that corner, in front of where the pedestrians are, put a low-level cycle.
Yeah, I think there's enough space to do that there as well, but we'll have to have a look at it. Again,
the amount of space should be in the standard.
Yeah.
How much space do you need for a cycle stop?
Well, for a cycle stop, they say, well, will a vehicle think that's a stop line as well? And say, well, will we have backing up? Will you not be able to clear the junction? It comes down to like safety audit stuff, really. If there's enough space for one vehicle to stall there, and that's the only risk of one vehicle getting across there. Because we've got a yellow block hatching as well, which you're not supposed to cross unless your exit's clear. There's a stop line there, you might think, oh, I can keep crossing it there and stop back. There's all sorts of stuff that's going on there. But in terms of what I'm talking about today, really, I just want a measure of like, well, how's it stack up compared to the junctions?
That junction is a very poor story because pedestrians can only go across
until they're out. Well, you'd say that's very poor. That's that 11 out of 24, like 40% is one of the best ones we've seen out there. There's a couple of all greens to make that happen. But like Dutch junctions, I will say, are all 100%. So what is it they do that we don't?
They're drivers, actually.
It's not just a behaviour thing either. Like the Danes, well, scoring 100%, because they're reintegrating. And yeah, they're reliant on behaviour. But that's only one of the measures in the level of service. You've got to be protected and field protected as well. So what kind of junctions score highest? Well, there's none in the UK, but like Camden are working on this, Hackney are working on one of these, and also Enfield, the spot there, Mini Holland, are working on the kind of Dutch style protected junction. This is what the Dutch do that we don't, really. They put the protection actually in the mouth of the junction itself, and basically cyclists go one way, general traffic goes around the other way, so you feel protected. You're in your own space and you've got your own time. You cross at the same time as pedestrians, but you're always giving way to them as you cross their path. So pedestrians are at the top of that hierarchy, cyclists next. And if we look at the method of control, all vehicles go there, all general traffic goes there, and then they're held all four arms and our pedestrians cross, and then the cyclists go at the same time, and they can kind of weave around in a kind of roundabout style motion whereas general traffic is the other way. There's no magic art to it, that's kind of what they do. It's kind of, we were looking at the Dutch roundabout, which is like a non-signalised larger version of this, but in that case the traffic circulates and so you need so much more space to actually turn large vehicles. This is what they do on sort of standard junctions, just let you weave through across there. So as a cyclist you can always filter through to the left. Good win there in terms of capacity, no delay at all, you're giving way to pedestrians as you go, but if you're doing any other movement, you go and wait for the stop line and then you put across same time as pedestrians, always giving way to them. That's what they do. There's an all green, all movement.
Yep.
I don't know what their location is yet, I'm not seeing, they've just told me that.
CFL haven't chosen to do that for Old Street, have
they? No, well.
Well,
there's plenty. Please go forth and campaign for them. I'll support it technically. That's
so pedestrians have constant flow.
Not in this one. It's signalised. So it's a little bit of a hybrid crossing there. So this bit's zebra. This bit's full signal. So yeah, everybody separated. You could try and do it like Dutch style and let everybody give way, but I don't think we've got the behaviour yet. I still think we need traffic signals at junctions, personally.
Is that the same thing as a green scramble, or not?
It's a separated scramble. So a scramble would be you'd let all peds, all cyclists go and cut across at the same area. This one, there's no conflict. Cyclists are still being told as they cross the path of pedestrians to formally give way for them. So although I'm letting them go at the same time, I'm not introducing a new stage which would be more time and then more delay. I'm letting them go at the same time, still there's no conflict with them. You're never cutting across their path.
Sorry, have you just said that in the middle of pedestrians and cyclists put together and anyone else?
In this particular junction design, they might do that. Or they'll have a quicker turnaround of cycles as well. So they might
right, like. No, I'm asking whether that's what I understood right.
Yeah, that's what I said about that. Yeah.
Right. Why is this objective to?
Because you can't have that conflict. A cycle is a vehicle. A pedestrian. You can't let them go on the same arm at the same time. Just basically like a dividing by zero for. Traffic engineers.
So you haven't got that there because you've got the zebra crossing across the cycle. I presume that would only work if you haven't got too many bicycles and pedestrians, because if you've got somewhere like the Oxford Street on Court Road, then the bicycles would never get across.
Yeah, they could be waiting there, but still held on a signal cycle and they'll find a way through. It's got to be the right context, and that's one of the key things we say in the LCDS really. You've got to do the right thing in the right context. So, yeah, if you've got really high cycle flows, to kind of moderate the ped flow, yeah, that will be the thing to do. If it's like completely dominated by pedestrians, maybe you want to look a bit more shared.
Are the cyclists not
being
held by any lights? Is it only zebras for their
cyclists? No, only when they turn to the left. When they do any other movement, there's a stop line there with the associated signal, so they pull over there to do any other movement. But doing left, okay. Yep.
Just for people present, if you haven't seen on YouTube Bicycle Dutch, has fantastic videos, and one of the best ones I think is called Intersection Redesign. It's Intersection Redesign in Utrecht, and it's taking it from far better than what we have here to something that's like that, and it shows both the layout, the plan, and it also shows the before and after actual people going through, so it really shows how the whole junction works.
Yeah, they're the masters. This is really my attempt to show it with our regs on the right side of the road. You know, that's really
what
I need to do there.
Can you
be
very brief on me only?
Sure.
What the principle is which stops that happening here?
Well, nothing. I'm trying to make this happen here.
What's the objection? Sorry.
Well, if the cyclists and pedestrians come into conflict.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be a problem.
The objection would be, let's treat that seriously, because what we do at a standard UK junction would be, because we do separate all the stages, we've already acknowledged that, so you need time for all those stages to kick in. Once you've got time, you've got delay. If you've got delay, then you need space for the cars to kind of stack, so they can, one, get through quickly to minimise that delay. So this area here, we'd have a left filter lane in there. We'd have to stack two lanes in there, because we're pulling up all these extra stages. So when this time comes round, we need two to go at the same time there to get them across the junction there. So it's to overcome that delay that we put in extra lanes, extra stacking lanes at junctions. In Holland and Denmark, where they've got quick turnaround, they can keep one lane on the link and one lane at the junction because you've got a really quick turnaround. We because we put that extra delay in there for pedestrians, we have to put stacking lanes in there. So that's what we'll tend to do.
Smoothing traffic flows to a priority and therefore traffic volume.
Everybody likes smooth traffic flow, cyclists traffic,
well,
bicycle traffic.
Smoothing traffic
flow
meant,
that as well.
Enabling large traffic volumes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I work at Transport for London, they're in control of the trunk network, and that's still how it's defined, and that's what the Act of Parliament governing those roads says we have to do. So, yeah, we're still taking that seriously.
Well, I know that was the Act of Parliament, but it was also Boris's priority.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was raised as a priority when Boris came in.
Yep. Yeah, no, yeah, don't
it
you,
wasn't
that's
necessarily
true.
Livingstone's priority, though it was in the then Act of Parliament.
Brian, contrary to your view that you need a light sequence, one of the things that's impressed me in Fitzrovia is taking away the lights projects uncertainty and has actually improved.
Oh, no, I agree. Well, you know, I've stuck out quite a few sets of lights.
Oh, really?
It's not like on a large junction like that, really, where it can kind of work if you're. If you want to make it feel completely safe and there's like multiple lanes of traffic, then yeah, we still need those lights. If you can reduce the amount of traffic going through an area and make it seem nicer, then it's better for everybody. So, yeah.
Sorry about this thing. Oh, I've got to get it going.
All right, no
the
worries.
Laptop.
What are we going to talk about next then? Oh yeah, I was going to go back to the actual two options then that we came up to. We're back at our five stages when we went through the level of service. I was going to show two options for what you could do that would give you the good mesh density and would give you like a favourite piece as well. So our option one was going to be, I'm just going to describe it for you magically, would be like a sort of Hackney style filtered permeability thing. In our any town, imagine it's still there, but that sort of town centre area we made like impermeable for anybody but pedestrians and cyclists. Then kind of zoned out the area around it. So by zoning, I mean that cars can go in, you can't go across to the next town. So if you lived there and you wanted to drive to there, you'd have to come up all the way around. That's to make it really circuitous and long to get around there. So basically all these roads, and every time it crosses, all those crossings are great. They all become like effectively gateways because it's only cycle traffic and pedestrian traffic crossing it. And the whole area works well as cycle routes. So that's option one, the sort of traffic management approach, which will get you there. And that's the approach favoured by Hackney. They're pretty successful with it. And I'll also say the best example of that would be Cambridge, I think, in this country. So people go, oh, well, Cambridge cycle infrastructure sucks. Like, look at it, there's not much going on there. Why is there so many cyclists in there? But if you try and drive a car through the centre of Cambridge, not that I'm suggesting any of you do, but if you did, you'd like find that you got to the town centre, you come across a bridge and it'd just be point closed in the middle. And you just turn round, get the hell out of town, go around the outer ring road and come back in the other side. It's a nightmare. So everybody like walks and cycles across there because that's just the way to get around there. Or you'll fall off the ditch into all the water protection as well. They've made it particularly difficult to drive in Cambridge, and the knock-on effect is that people like choose different options. So that's our option one. Pretty bold. I did ask Hackney and go, how do you sell that sort of thing? And basically, once you do that first one, like, if we looked at the Mini Holland, like Waltham Forest have been doing that kind of approach at the moment of adopting that style. Once you do the first one, that's the tough one. And then everybody sees the effects of having no through traffic and how lovely an area becomes. And they'll go, yeah, I want that. So it's a big sell. Yeah, and you get exclusivity over your street. Your kids can go out and play. It's not like just through traffic dominating. So it does work pretty well. Our option two was the kind of more vision aligned option. Really, those bits of like those strands of LCN we kind of connected. Like there was a little bit of land purchase down the bottom. To get over to the NCN from the green route, we had like a bit of a bridge connection. The sort of connector road on the side there, like super highwayed it. So basically put in like a quiet way routes at the right kind of mesh density. And basically the key point I wanted to make was that all the infrastructure choices were led by the network cohesion. That's the first one. We needed a new bridge. Alright, maybe that would cost £6 million, but that's the only way of getting the right mesh density in that area to make that connection. It just has to be done. There's no other options. That's the overall like plan. Like where the quiet way intersected with the super highway, maybe there with just a fire protected junction we're going to have really high cycle flow. So everything's being led by the network. It's not what we do in the past where, as an engineer, we're told, oh, you're looking at this part of Camden this year. Go and have a look at that road there and you know, some people go, get in a tube, pop up, go, oh, I'm looking here, what should I do, share space or something, what's happening with the overall network? We need to decide what needs to be done first, where do the crossings need to go, how do we get a basic network, and that should lead the plan and build. So that was that second option. And now,
yes, about
them. You can just imagine what they look like.
How do you get over consultations? When you're designing, you're thinking, well, it's a great plan, but it'll just fall
back. Yeah, people do design to pass a consultation, and they're designed to pass a safety order as well. All the things that you tell them not to do, people think, oh, we'll never be able to do that in Hampstead. Well, what's the point of even trying?
Yeah.
They're just going to want that. Well, maybe we'll get the zebra on. They don't even like tankers now. Well, let's do something to happen for them. You do get that kind of conversation happen, which you all kind of see. So, yeah, but if you've got a plan, and this is what I want to move to at the moment. I've got the design standards and we've got the kind of vision. And now we need a plan. And that could be it might take 5 years, it might take 10 years to do. We need a plan going, this is the way it all comes together, this is what we're all working to. The vision should be the bare bones. Every scheme should be a cycling scheme and everything should fit into our overall plan of making London work. So that's why I want to get to really a master plan. I think if I was scoring policy, which we're going to talk about in a minute, I think the Germans do the master plan the best. It's kind of there, and the Danish have been doing it for 30 years, so it's kind of all come together. I don't really want to wait 30 years, I need a plan. I need to get all German on this and lay it down where I'm actually doing anything. Sorry if there's any Germans, I do love Germans. I've forgiven them after 100 years.
Don't you have a bit of a problem that Boris's mind is elsewhere now? He's after being Prime Minister and MP for Ealing, and he's no longer really engaged with this, and he's deferring things till 2020 for the ultra low emission zone.
That's why
so
I need a plan.
There'll be perhaps a switch of mayor quite soon, and you'll find yourself high and dry. Yeah, I agree with your 5 or 10 year approach.
Yeah, no, it's happened before. Yeah, I specialise in cycling. You know, it's going to be peaks and troughs. Peaking at the moment, and it's quite a peak, and I'm enjoying it. But yeah, it could well go to. Actually, we've gone back to buses now. What was that cycling nonsense that was going on there? Which is why I want a coherent master plan that people sign up to and we go, yes, this is the basics of what we're doing. Everybody likes it. I think we're getting to a stage now with cycling campaigning where there's stuff you can say, I like that, I want more of it, rather than what it was for years ago.
Certainly the public reaction to east, west and north, south seems to be absolutely overwhelmingly good.
And so Boris, any kind of politician, will want stuff to be done so we can say, I did that. That's really what he wants at the end of the day. So what's ever going to deliver it? If we're all saying that the north, south and east, west were crap, then you go, well, what's the point of doing that? No one's going to let me do it. They're not even supporting it. So the fact that we're all united and we're saying, this is all good, and letting everybody hear about it can only be good there. Oh, okay. Back in there.
Finally,
I've probably taken up the whole time just filling time on that one there, but I will keep going to give you the whole balance. I will bring it back. I will bring it back. It's quite a jazz riff I've been on, but it's all going to come back to the balance eventually. And we're getting there. So
it's wind time.
The laptop was running on its battery the whole time when I thought it was running on the adapter, and it eventually.
It seems to me that you're kind of on board with the sort of things that I would hope for. What is it that we can do to be helping you sort of make sure that your other officers are implementing some of these sort of super duper ideas?
Well, yeah, I mean, one that comes from the knowledge that you've all heard and you're all on board. I can't maybe get to every borough officer, but you guys can. You'll work in your own. Like Jean and I and John, we've been hatching plans together for many years, and I could come up with something, and like Paul Braithwaite there as well, we'll hatch something. We're going, you speak to the councillors, we'll get someone to speak to Boris, you speak to the officers, come in, and then get someone to order me to do it. that's my way of doing it, really. So I'm letting you know the stuff so you can go, yeah, this is what I want. You know, we can articulate what it is that we require in a network, not just an individual bits of infrastructure.
Kind of must read this.
your kind of...
Oh yeah, well I'll leave you the slides as well, you can have a look through, I can't remember which bit, but the draft cycle safety action plan, it's full version now, the version 2 of that, that's definitely worth a read. Just look at the actions, they are bold. So I'm going to talk now about some of the other elements, and I'm going to cover these bits quite quickly. I'm going to talk about my stakeholder rules of engagement, really, which I think is quite interesting, which is going to come there. Then I'm going to talk about policy assessment. And I'm also going to talk about like measuring people's intention to cycle, so a bit of user satisfaction. They're the other elements of the bicycle balance, and then we'll bring it all together at the end. And we're getting there, aren't we, George?
At last. Sorry about this.
That's all right. I will say, people often ask me to talk for 20 minutes, and I did an LCC talk on the design standards about a year and a half ago. I had a 20-minute slot and talked for about 2 hours. Just tell them to shut up and stop if it gets too much. But I will bring it all back in. Yeah, there we go. So there's the option there, the filtered permeability option, just to show that's what that means. You can go in, but you can't go across. You can't go around. So I won't explain that because I've already explained it. And there's the kind of vision one. So everything being led by the network. That's what we want. If you ran the same process over there, you'd see that the gateways are there, the density was there, and it all kind of looks well. Well, let's have a look at stakeholder engagement. That's you guys. This here, I just thought I'd throw this in there, this is Sherry Arnstein's Ladder of Active Citizen Participation from 1969. I love this, and I love social psychology. As an engineer, it's a outrageous thing to admit, but it's true. These are the different levels of engagement you can give citizens, really. You want from like a straight up manipulating them, just saying, we're doing this, get over it. I don't even need care if you get over it. So we all kind of know about those consultations, like, you know, a crossrail or something like that. Right through to just like straightforward informing the normal kind of consultation level, placating a, all right, we're doing this, you know, feed in slightly, that's all good, have you got some ideas? Working with partnership, which I think Cameron Cycling Campaign does pretty damn well with the council. They ask you for advice, you like a feed in, you're definitely getting up that ladder there to like a delegated power. Here's all the things you can do, you decide. So it's not like a, we'll just do whatever you want. That's at the top of the ladder, full citizen control. Just do what you want on the highway there. We don't care. You know, that would be at that level.
So really,
I mean, the highest we get up there is the kind of DIY streets, really, which is kind of a little bit delegated power. We'll give you all these options. You can kind of choose within them, really. And that full, like, takeover. In Portland, they do things where they let citizens go out and, like, paint intersections and stuff and just kind of got themselves. But they can't, like, alter the structure of the road, so... Maybe we haven't got there, not in terms of highway engineering. But what I do ask people to think of, if you are doing any kind of meaningful consultation, to choose your kind of level of engagement and be honest about it going well. Maybe at TfL, we're really just informing. And you can aggressively feed back to us, but you know, whatever, it's been decided. We've been working on this for 2 years. So really, like, that's the kind of level. So the superhighway's kind of low down. And maybe that's right. And maybe like it. If someone's just changing your drainage in the street, do you really want to have the delegated power to do that? You just want them to do it and just maybe inform you, maybe not, just make sure it all works. So there's cases to be made for coming in at any stage on the ladder, really. Central London Grid, a little bit contested space, I might go a bit higher, but the quiet ways are the ones that I really want people to work in. I like really have them reflect local character and like places, really. That's when we can be a bit more creative and offer a bit more control to people. So that's how I thought I'd introduce the ladder there. You can see why they didn't let me put any of this stuff in there, but I thought I'd share. Right, so I'm going to skip through this quickly, but there's like in transport planning, there's a theory of planned behaviour, which like people put a lot of stock in, really. It's about measuring people's intention to do something, really. So I've got like everything comes down to these like 0, 1, 2 scores, really. And there's the overall scoring range. So do local people in centre cycle? Why would I spend money in Camden if nobody actually intended to cycle anyway? And how do I measure that intention? So there are theories from social psychology to do that. So if you ask people, like, if you're using a quiet way, what would your route to work be like? Well, Would it be healthy? Would it be inexpensive? Would it be safe? If your route's already safe, then maybe you don't need anything. And this one here, so you measure how the route would be. And this one here is how important do you think that is to yourself. If it's not particularly safe, but you don't care, so you put a minus score there, then that doesn't factor in there. If it isn't safe, but you really care about safety, then that's going to be a multiplying factor. That's against you. That's working against your intention to cycle. Yeah. We'll go in there. And then a little bit of maths there, because everything becomes a number in my worldview. You can times one by the other, and it gives you like a that subjective evaluation. Moving on, really, like... My friends are opposed to me cycling. You know what? I don't care what my friends do. My family would love me to cycle, but I really care what my family think. That's going to influence my intention to cycle. You can ask and you can get information that's going to be relative to that. This all adds in again. How easy or hard it is. So without like a quiet way, it's going to be really difficult for me to get to route. The control power over that, it's all starting to get a little bit more like a... belief orientated that yeah, go on.
It's going to be back tested. I mean, after you put the stuff in, did any of that scoring come true, or did it fall back to if I build it, then come anyway?
Well, one of the few examples I can think of what kind of post monitoring is going on at the moment in Camden on Royal College Street, so we will actually have some stats. Did all that stuff we say actually come to fruition? Did we get more women cycling? Did we get more people cycling in general? Was it more people from the local area? All the stuff that you put into the consultation and helped to make the case, but did it actually come out there? It's all about building up that case for the capital spend, but then finding revenue funding to support the argument to feed into future ones is something we haven't done a lot of, but we are looking at. So there's not a lot, but there's a really good example on them. All ears for when that comes through there. Well, anyway, when you add all that together, you can get your attitude, your subjective, your perceived control, and you get an overall score. And there's a few sort of controlling factors. So it doesn't matter how you score. If you haven't got access to a bicycle, you're not going to ride a bike. Just like a few little sense checks, really. These are my little checks in itself. Any kind of a no here would mean it scores zero. Otherwise, it's going to be scored from the kind of range there, really.
But I know people who say, no, there's no cycling near where I work. And you say, but it's there. It's anywhere I've never noticed because they don't cycle.
Yeah, well, that's what we need to find out. That's a measure of their intention to cycle, yeah. So let's find out in the area. So anyway, that'll give you an overall score based on that. So that's another way of getting scores. You can see whether the local people actually intend to do it or not. What's also important is what the local authority policies are like. And this is where I was getting really controversial now when I wanted to actually measure people's policies. So if I, as a Transport London engineer, decide to offer 40 million to Camden to do a route, but then Camden decides to put free parking either end and build a new dual carriageway beside it, that's not particularly like a favourable policy to go along there. That would pretty much be a waste of money to do that alongside there. So this is where we're looking at. So we're looking at what's their cycle maintenance? How did they do their consultations? Did it work in partnership? What was their delivery record like? What's their action plans? What's their policy framework like? What's their staff structure? Did they train them? Have they got cycling facilities? What's the maintenance like? What's their monitoring like? How do they work as an authority? Are they going to spend the money well? Can they actually deliver? Are they supportive of like active travel? This is the kind of measure there. Well, yeah, I mean, there's this way of looking at it. There's also like the EU have done a lot of work. They've got like an audit called the BiPAD audit, which you can like assess, and it's well worth looking out on the internet. It's an alternative to this as well. There's a few boroughs in London that have done it. I think Southwark did it. Islington haven't done it. Camden haven't done it either. But there's quite a few cities that you can kind of benchmark yourself across Europe. That bit really, I think it's really useful. That's a lot more in depth than this. This is just like it's friendly towards cyclists or not, but you can get really into that detail. And it's particularly popular in Europe, this kind of policy benchmarking. I'd like to see it thrown in there. That again gives your overall scores. There's the ranges, more zero, ones, and twos. The impact on pedestrians, I just pull up this one element of the level of service. Does the cycle route impact on pedestrian comfort level? It makes them worse. There's no impact. It makes it better. I think that's absolutely program critical. So we brought that up to the front level of the bicycle. So without any further ado, let's see what these things look like when you measure it all together. All the stuff from the level of service against like the policy and the user satisfaction and and everything else. Here's some like suggested profiles for each one of the mayor's vision elements. So for a superhighway, it's not going to be very adaptable. Okay, fair enough, that's not going to be of our main importance. It is important that it's direct and safe and comfortable. They're all given, and it's coherence. We're probably really defining the superhighways on how coherent they are. We don't want it to impact on pedestrians, particularly when it gets to central area. But policy, not that vital to have like a well-formed policy, because transport for London are controlling these routes anyway. We don't really have to work with willing local authorities or whatever. So, and you know, the attractiveness might be like a key feature of a superhighway. They're getting more attractive, but yeah, there you go. There's a kind of profile for there. On the central London grid, we're being more grid-like, want it to be a lot more adaptable and changeable. Or maybe like the impact on that is that they're not as direct. So we'll accept more of like a detour. Policy-wise, well, it's got to happen, so we're just going to make it go even if the local policies aren't completely supportive towards it. Whereas, well, this is like a desire line. How it works out and how you measure, you have to run this system over it. I'd say, well, I'm working on the quiet wayfinding strategy at the moment, and that will make it fairly coherent to follow. But the fact that it's a grid and it's kind of back streets, make your own mind, it's not going to be as coherent as following a superhighway and a dead straight line along the main road, nor should we expect it to be. So there's a kind of a grid balance view, whether that would work. What you'd want to aim for if you assessed it all there, really. On a quiet way, well, we're skewed over to one side here. Maybe they'll be a lot less direct. Maybe the user satisfaction doesn't need to be that high. We'll try better. Still, it's got to be safety. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to be coherent. It's got to be attractive. This is where attractiveness gets maxed out. For me, that's how I'd like to define quiet ways, that they're the most attractive routes. You feel calmer. It's our new type of cyclist that we want to get in there. The logos with a scarf lying in the background. It's more casual. I mean, it's got to be attractive. You can't be routing them through industrial estates and just not doing anything there. It's got to be an inviting, interesting place where you can see the back streets of London. So attractiveness comes out there.
They're not going to use it, though. I don't understand how, you know...
Well, yeah, that was more like a measure of like the intention. So even if they don't like a intend to necessarily use it and they're not particularly satisfied with it, well, you might still do it anyway because it's cheaper interventions. And so it's not maxed out there. Whereas like maybe on... I'll show you if the next one is like a user satisfaction one. Mini Hollands, that's where we really need to work with the willing. This is transformational change, and we really need to know that where we're putting this unprecedented like funding in, that people actually intend to cycle and do it in the first place. So that's why we asked them about that, really. Adaptable, it doesn't have to be as adaptable in the quiet ways, but still we need like everything else pretty much maxed out. Maybe we can take a slight hit in directness, but the Mini Hollands has got to be transformational, the highest kind of quality stuff we got out there. So pretty much everything's got to be aiming for the stars on it, really, including the user satisfaction, their intention. So that was balanced. I got back there in the end, didn't we? So that's kind of the end. I mean, I can keep going. I've got some examples, but I think you've probably had enough, haven't you?
I think it's out of questions and refreshments.
Great.
Good stuff. Thanks for listening.
We've got a particular problem in East Kentish Town where we're trying to improve the quietness of the area and make it safer for cyclists as an alternative to Kentish Town Road. But one of the things that's screaming through to me is that the default position mindset is no change. I mean, 8 years ago when I started to get involved in putting in streetcars, they didn't want them. I mean, the average streetcar takes 8 or 10 cars off the road. The post-evaluation is, oh, that was really good. Yes, it's improved the area. But the mindset that starts from no change is what I want seems to me to be a huge hurdle. And we can turn around to them and say, but they did it in Primrose Hill, and they now all really like it. Doesn't seem to be getting through.
Yeah, we'll all say, oh, that's Primrose Hill. for giving it the same borough at the top level. And then they go, oh, well, they did it on the street over there. Oh, yeah, there's people on that street now. Always up to that. That's what's kind of got, and that's why I think like the Waltham Forest Mini Holland stuff that they've been doing is brilliant. And the fact like they did a little filtered permeability for a trial, ran it for like 2 weeks, closed off roads, made little play streets, put little parks out, like made it all kind of work, and tried it out with temporary materials for 2 weeks. And well, yeah, lots of people got really annoyed. They couldn't drive where they wanted to. Other people were like, oh, this is fantastic. It's a new place I'm living in. Test it out there, and then immediately go to the consultation after that and go, you know, that thing that we did you like it or not? And everybody's got an opinion then, and you've all tested it. So I think trialing is like the way to go. I see Camden like have been at the forefront of trialing as well. So I think in that area, do something, see what you think about it. Go, well, how did that affect you? Do you want more of that? Do you want us to never come here again with that kind of nonsense? Let us know. But that's the way to drag an opinion. So otherwise, if you present someone with a drawing, like if we went in like the Walthamstow Village, and it was a drawing of like a little points on a map of something else, we go, what the hell's that? I don't care. Throw it in the bin. Yeah, but like you do,
it's if you get them
all
to
those points
take
for like
an extra 5 minutes to buy my petrol once a month.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's if you get them to the meeting. The beauty of trialing is that people come across it,
everybody's,
and even if it's just for 2 weeks, like you say.
Yeah, you're talking Scottish referendum level of feedback if
you're
on the street. So good. That's why I'd recommend in an area like that when it's tough. And that making the case of that first change is always
we do observe that it's really a setback for the officers, who are very stretched when they're meeting with an organised hostile campaign that says you're trying to save £80 million, here's one play, when it's not even Camden's money.
No, indeed, it's tough. So spring something on them.
On the Waltham Forest Group, has there been any feedback? I mean, you said you very strongly support trialling, but do we think the local ward councillors support trialling in Waltham Forest?
Well, there was one way to find out, and that's the trial.
Will they get re-elected? No, I'm sorry, I'm being a bit cynical.
Yeah, no, fair enough, but it's a big risk for everybody, and the officers, and they haven't really done anything as bold as that before. But we'd asked them, they got the money on the premise that they were going to make a transformational change, so they tried it. Now on the bottom, we'll see what the fallback is. And I mean, looking at the consultation, it's looking like it was kind of 50-50, but a lot of people loved it. I went out to the trial a couple of times and had a whole host of responses from people like threatening me and going, oh, what are you doing? And all that sort of people coming out and just going, actually, this is fantastic. We love our street now and do more of it. So that's the way, and councillors love hearing that stuff. They're all walking around and testing it out, going, are we ready for this in this area? That's the way to find out.
So the junction assessment tool, is that part of the
cycle
safety action plan as well?
No.
Where could I find the
chapter? It's in the LCDS. It's in chapter 2. It's kind of like, because the level of service is asking quite a lot of detail, I just wanted a real quick way for people to assess junctions, like, and get scores in relation to safety there. So it's a kind of add-on.
Really useful for assessing, for instance,
archway proposals. Please do. If you turn up, I mean, it's easy to follow. You turn up and go, we've assessed it.
Yeah.
This is scoring 24%. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Please do. They're the conversations I'd rather have. Rather than, oh, we want some for cycling. Oh, what can you do? Well, give me some ASLs. Oh, I can't do anything else. Now we say, well, no, it's not good enough. We want to get decent scores.
Someone mentioned just the volume of cars. Or is there any movement in all of this conversation around reducing parking?
And the level of parking. Parking's a tricky one. If it was reducing actual traffic volumes, we could do it, but parking's a tricky one. Even if people don't drive much in this town, they still like the parking space and consider it part of their property. So I like what we did in Royal College Street, shifting the parking out and using it, because nobody's using the cars. Use it to segregate a contraflow lane with a bit of buffering. Portable segregation devices, I like to call cars. You know, but they can work positively. I mean, another example I'll kind of give, if you've got like a standard, like a UK, like carriageway, 7.3 metres wide, we'll go 12 foot as it used to be. That's going to give you two 3.65 lanes, which we already talked about as the worst possible lane width. You're throwing a row of parking down one side, you've got two narrow lanes, and you've got yourself a quiet road. Parking is one of the most effective traffic calming techniques we have out there, so it doesn't have to be all bad. Doesn't have to be. It's all about the use of that parking. If it's like if it's by a high street and people are constantly in and out, you've got a tight cycle lane up to it, yeah, that's a nightmare situation. But in certain contexts, it can actually be a beneficial thing to throw in some parking. So,
but there's still too much of it.
By and large, yes, I'd love to call out great waves. Are we ready yet? Yeah, I don't think so.
Because I live on some college place and we finally got a cycle hang. A bike hang.
Yeah,
but that took 3 years for one space to disappear.
No, that was one of my schemes. So
yeah.
Sorry about it taking
that
long.
No, we finally got it.
Yeah, what a flaw, but that was.
Yeah,
but in some parts of Canada, the parking pressure on parking is going down, isn't it? So that some areas, then they're underutilised, they can take out parking spaces. So there
well, I might think there was. Yeah. That's what I'm wondering.
The way we tried to do it, well, one, get car-free developments was our sort of approach, and two, like do a little bit of an audit go around, try and reduce it by a certain amount there. But it's just if you take one parking place up one street, then everybody's going to know it. It's really hard to incrementally reduce it.
Yes.
If we are to abide to ask the council in reason or anywhere, since they are adding car spaces anyway, so if I go and say, why don't you put them here? So you and then we put a cycle lane on the. What would they say? Can you please put this new car parking that you are adding here? Where would I advise them to put it?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, you feed into all designs, don't you? No, it's all right. Well, you should be looking at every design, and I think, like, campaigners here do, you get to see every design that's come through Camden, big, small, and I know you respond to all consultations. Any parking change will be consulted on, so that's your time to say. Yeah, no, it's a tricky one, because, I mean, it would be a lot, and every crossover application and stuff like that. Not proposing to do that, but that'd be, you know, there's certain streets. Maybe we've highlighted it through some like a network coherence plan. You go, this is the key street for us if we can make something nice down there. But we have to get rid of parking. So next time something happens on that street, you go to that. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm saying like you'd have to make a strong justification for removing parking. So it'd have to be for some real massive network.
What I'm saying is, they're adding car parking. So if I want that to be an obstacle to more traffic,
You'd have to take each thing specifically, really. If they're saying, oh, we're going to, like Tower Hamlets are doing as well, we're going to put like X amount percentage more car parking space in.
So
that isn't
in our doing.
If I
stay there, they're going to laugh.
Yeah. It's a tricky one. Now I'm not even sure how they're playing it. How are they all fitting these new spaces in? Or every time they do a new development, they're just going to include all the parking associated with that as
And they say that all the new housing is car free. So I don't know when they're adding this.
Yeah, I don't know either, because Islington's quite small.
They're definitely adding 844, and they're marketing 1200, which are currently empty. Yeah.
They might just be adjusting where there's like loading restrictions and stuff. That's the way I did it. If someone came to me and said, find loads of more parking space, I'd look at all my double yellows and I was going, oh, extend that bit and I'll call that parking bay now. And it was parking before and it was loading before. So I could say I've put a formal space in there. They might be doing stuff like that. So it's hard to say I want my parking there. I think you'd have to find a street where you consider parking would make an improvement. And I'm sure they'd hear you. And that would have to be a parking demand there as well.
Alex.
There's a thing the DFCA have at the moment asking about segregating funds, as it were, for maintenance of cycling infrastructure. What do you think in terms of how much do we need to be careful about if we build infrastructure, we actually have budget around to maintain it, rather than just worrying about adaptability? But also, I've always personally been quite taken the idea that maintenance is an opportunity to change things. How much opportunity really is there, given that you might need consultation otherwise? In a regular maintenance scenario, is there much opportunity to change?
Depends what borough you're in. Some boroughs get really bold when they're resurfacing and just change all the lines around. Others like would want full reconsultation, like 20 mil change. Depends where you are. Like in in Lambeth, every resurfacing in Lambeth is an opportunity for them to do something mental for cyclists, and they will just do it. And they might not even necessarily consult or put traffic orders through. And it depends on the area, which I fully support, and I help them go, oh, you're doing that road, why don't you try bicycle streets and all stuff in there? And they'll just go ahead and do it, but it depends where you are. So in terms of the scope, if they're playing by the rules, there's not much. They should try and tie it all up, but it rarely happens. But it should do more. So yeah, no, terrible answer there, but it depends which borough you're talking about and like what the individual situation
is. Just very briefly, in terms of maintenance funds, how much, because I think one of the criticisms of the superhighways, beyond all the safety aspects, was that they were flaking and they weren't necessarily maintained as well as was promised. And that, there was an idea in the level of service offered to the user that potholes would be fixed quicker than normally, and actually
It
seems just as bad anywhere else.
Yeah, now when we put that in the LCDS again, and that idea of prestige routes that you'd concentrate on first and foremost, and I can say TfL we prioritise the cycle routes, but still there's a maintenance backlog across the country, and particularly in London as well, so yeah, it's a tricky one. Those potholes keep coming, and just keep reporting them to your council is all I'm going to say really on that one. The tricky one, with the superhighways, when we went in there, we had to resurface a lot of the roads just to apply the blue surface to it. But then these are, when it's a busy road and you've got loads of buses and HGVs on it, you're getting 6 months out of any kind of colour treatment on top of it, so it's going to start coming apart. You'll see like Euston Road, that's like, 5 years ago they resurfaced it outside the old town hall there. All rutted up within like a year really. We're not getting 25 year life cycles out of our roads like we should be doing, so yeah, it's a tricky one, that maintenance one. But I will say there is a lot of money in road maintenance, and we are trying to get cycling up top of it, and it's there written in policy, just they're not seeing it in practice yet.
Okay, a couple more questions, Charlie.
When trialling a scheme, would you suggest that it's necessary to consult before the trial and after the trial as well?
Well, I think the Waltham Forest one is a good example, because they didn't consult, they just did it. I go, what do you think about that? Depends what the scheme is. But I think if you want to trial it, then that implies that there's no consultation, just seeing whether it works or not.
I think that Brent, give it a go. The council, they think, yes, in theory they can, but in practice they say no, they wouldn't be practical.
It depends on the nature of the trial. Well, look at like Narrow Way in Hackney, that's a really famous trial, but that was consulted on, so we couldn't do this. And, I mean, it took like a 18 months discussion with buses and going through all the process just to do a trial there, so it can be quite an involved thing.
The Waltham Forest was only a couple of weeks. It was quite different from the usual 6 months or a year.
Yeah, it depends what the scheme is, but I'm still a fan of trialing. Yeah, I mean, I've done trials in the past for 2 weeks, and I've had to trial it again, like 6 months later, because there was all sorts of stuff going wrong, but that's why you trial, isn't it?
David, did you want to ask something?
Well, I was going to mention that when I spoke to the Brent officers about the subject of resurfacing recently, and why don't they make minor changes to traffic islands and to cycle gaps when they're doing that to make stuff better, and they said it's because the budget comes from directly from the DOT, it's a budget for just for resurfacing, not for doing anything else, and we can't use it for doing anything but exactly reinstating it as it was. So would you say that's wrong, though?
Yeah, no, I'd say that's a very inflexible way of looking at it. It's not, well, some departments will work like that. We've got our budget and that's what we do. And they're the creative ones and they spend the TfL money or the lip funding ones. But a good department should be working across the board. And I gave an example of a good one. Let's look at the way Lambeth do it. Yeah. They all talk to each other. And they just, so they get the maximum amount of change each year because all the budgets are working together. I think that's best practice. So, but like it might be that's just the way they're structured at Brent to work like that. Yeah. And that's the way a lot of local authorities are structured.
Yes, compartmentalisation.
Yeah, it isn't good, and it's not what we recommend in standards or TfL.
It's very hard for campaigners to influence that, almost impossible.
Well, yeah, without getting to know the officers involved and talk to them and going on there. Depends, like in Camden, it's good because you've got like you know, people like John Futcher who take a little bit of an overview role, and he'll kind of have some kind of idea what's happening maintenance ago. Maybe we can latch on to that. You know, like Royal Coast, we knew the maintenance was coming, but brought it forward like 5 years, so I didn't have to pay that cost. Yeah.
Okay, one last question.
You mentioned about getting all German and having a master plan for the network. I wondered if there is one being developed.
Yeah,
and because I campaigned for the kind of safe routes to schools, and we didn't get the cycle to school partnership
in Tuffenbach.
I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know if anyone did, or that was sort of.
Well, nobody got their money in the end.
Right.
It was a real, I mean, it wasn't my choice.
But what I was thinking was that, you know, if there's a network, we can say, well, you know, this provides linkages in the network, and I can see, you know, what you mentioned about.